At 11:30 this morning, Lord Mountbatten's family, accompanied by Paul Maxwell, a 15-year-old schoolboy from nearby Enniskillen, set off from the jetty. 16 minutes later, it happened.
The explosion was witnessed by two guards along the cliff path who were keeping an eye on Lord Mountbatten's green and white boat, the Shadow Five. It was violent in the extreme and was heard across the bay 2 miles away. The wreckage is now under forensic examination, and police are saying that they're treating it as a murder inquiry.
As soon as the explosion occurred at this spot, where a solitary orange boy now bobs among the lobster pots, nearby vessels and speedboats rushed to the rescue. The Garda and the army set up immediate roadblocks, while the residents of this tiny village gathered in sightseeing knots, more bewildered and shocked than anything else. Those who had heard the explosion said it was a miracle that anyone could have survived. The wreckage floated in sad flotsam over a wide area, proof of the stories that Shadow Five had disintegrated into matchwood with the blast. Lord Mountbatten and his young boatman were killed immediately. 3 hours later, police launches recovered the body of Lord Mountbatten's 14-year-old grandson. There were other tragic fragments of debris that the convoy of police boats brought back to harbour for forensic tests, including cushions and a fishing rod. The deaths occurred within sight of Classybourne Castle, which had been the Earl's Irish home for over 30 years.
A dreadful event in Irish history from 30 years ago, August 1979. There were survivors from the IRA bomb that killed Lord Mountbatten. One of those survivors has written a book 30 years on. Timothy Knatchbull, good evening to you.
Good evening to you, Matt.
Thank you for taking the time to join us. Is it difficult for you to actually hear that report again 30 years on?
Well, no, of course, on the day I didn't hear it because I was lying in a hospital bed in intensive care in Sligo, and all of this was going on to some large degree with me quite unaware. I knew something had happened, but it was really only after I came out of an emergency operation that afternoon that the full magnitude of it slowly began to seep in. I spent 3 days in intensive care, and it was on the fourth day in hospital that one of my family came to me and explained that not only were my beloved grandparents dead and Paul Maxwell, but the real hammer blow for me, the moment that changed my life, was when they told me that my identical twin brother, Nicholas, was dead.
How did you cope with that?
Well, it was a calamitous moment in my life, the worst moment in my life possible. We'd grown up in an intensely close family. We were the youngest of seven children, and we were identical. He was christened Nicholas Timothy. I was christened Timothy Nicholas, and my parents brought us up really identically so that we were dressed in similar clothes, led a similar life, and really we were never more than a heartbeat away in the first 14 years of my life. I think I only spent 4 or 5 days apart from Nicholas. Really, he was truly my soulmate. So when I looked into one of my sister's eyes as she gave me the news, she said to me, "When you came to the hospital, you were only semi-conscious, in and out of consciousness. You woke up, and Nicky never did." And in that moment, I realized that my entire life, my whole conception of what it meant to be alive, was going to be changed forever. And I looked into her eyes, and as slowly she dissolved into tears, I followed her. And it was, I wanted to give a signal to my family that I was strong and I was well, that I was a survivor, that I was going to carry on in the way they were. And I did my best to do so, and I managed to piece together my life. We went back to England a little over 2 weeks later, and within a few months more, I was able to go back to school and start picking up my life.
But how hard must that have been? We think of, particularly from the British aristocracy, a certain degree of reserve and stiff upper lip. Did you exhibit that, or was that perhaps in some way damaging to your ability to cope with what had happened to you and what had happened to your twin brother?
Well, of course, the culture was that a young man or a boy growing up into a young man, there was a certain expectation that try to be strong and not show your emotions too much. But I had a very loving, supportive family, brothers and sisters, mother and father, who helped me enormously get through that period of time. But the signal I wanted to send to them and to the rest of the world is that I was all right. I didn't want them to worry too much. And slowly, I think at times maybe I fooled them, i.e. perhaps more damagingly, fooled myself, because as my physical wounds began to heal, I was left with some lasting emotional and mental wounds that really wouldn't go away. And in later life, when I was in my early 30s, I addressed these. I went through some therapy, and that really started making me aware of the need to open up and become healthy in a way that I hadn't before. I met the love of my life, my wife Isabella. We had children, and in 2000, when my first daughter was born, I had an extraordinary moment looking into my newborn daughter's eyes. She's called Amber, and looking at her, I was filled not just with a father's love, which any father knows, but also with this desire to protect one's child, and also at the same time an acknowledgement of the futility of that hope that I would be able to protect her from hurt all life. But much more than that, something else came through, which was a desire to reach out to the very extraordinary people who on that day in 1979 had pulled me from the water, undoubtedly had saved my life by motoring over. They saw something floating. They thought it was a football. They grabbed hold of it. It was a man and a woman in a small boat, and they found that it wasn't a football. It was a head, a human head, my head. And as they started to pull into the boat, they didn't know what they were going to find. Was there a head attached to a body? Were there going to be legs? Well, I was lucky enough to keep all of my limbs. I lost only the sight in one eye and some of the hearing in one ear. And as I lay in the bottom of the boat, I knew something awful had happened. But many years later, as I looked into my own daughter's eyes, I realized what an incredible gift life was. And I wrote to those two people to say thank you for every day of life they'd given me and for the miracle of being able to look into my newborn daughter's eyes. And from that moment on, I realized that was a completion of a journey of healing and truth, forgiveness, reconciliation that I needed to go through. And happily married and with children, for the first time I felt emotionally secure enough to come back to Ireland, a place that I had grown up loving all my life. And despite the attack, that love had never left me. I had left Ireland in 1979 predominantly with the images I'd taken away from Sligo of love and care and attention from the people of Mullagh Mór, from the professionals in the hospital. And as I went back, I decided to go back in 2003 to revisit it. So very quietly, very privately, I slipped back into the west of Ireland and spent 4 or 5 days, sometimes a week at a time, 1 month and then another month and another month, starting in 2003, and after 12 months, finishing on the 25th anniversary of the bomb.
And what good did that do you?
Well, it was a process, really, Matt, of trying to come to terms and complete a process of healing. Now, I didn't really know what the questions were that I needed to have answered when I went back, but I began to realize as I went there, and I spoke with our neighbors, our friends, relatives, the community, I began to realize that there was an awful lot more to the picture than I had understood before. And I began to realize that if I wanted to become truly forgiving, that I needed to know much more about the attack. And there was precious little known about it. So I simply went about finding out the information firsthand for myself, piecing together, almost forensically, a picture of what had happened, of who had moved against us, why, how, when. These were questions that I needed to have answered.
Had they not been answered in the court case that there had been?
Well, of course, the court case had addressed some of those issues, but because of the way that a court case works, only a small amount of the picture will come to the surface. And as I answered for myself many of these questions, I found that the feelings that I needed to reconnect with came to the fore. And the primordial, overriding feeling that I needed was this. I had had no goodbye to Nick, my twin brother. There'd never been a moment when I'd looked into his eyes or at his dead body. There'd never been a moment for me to be in a church service at his funeral, because as he was buried in England, my parents and I lay in the hospital beds in Sligo, unable to be there. And finally, in 2004, I had completed that process. I had been back. I had pieced together what I needed to. Not just the facts, Matt, but really the feelings, the background and understanding. And I was able to say goodbye to him in a way that I'd never done before. And with that goodbye came a hello to the present I was living in, to my wife and my children, my job, and my neighbours, my own community. And to lead that life in a much more full and enriched way has been the most fantastic gift and a reward from for me, for giving back is how I feel.
A couple of things out of that. Did you suffer, in a sense, from what it might be termed the survivor's guilt, in wondering, is it, why is it that I survived? And from what you've described, almost a miracle that you were pulled from the water and that you managed to live, whereas your brother died.
I never did feel that survivor's guilt. I felt other complex emotions, but I remember both in the years following it and many years later discussing this with my parents, my father, who'd gone through the Second World War. And it simply, survivor guilt wasn't something that I felt. It was much more complicated than that. There was a wonder, there was an extraordinary sense when I went back in 2003 and stood on the little strip of sand where the boat had landed me ashore after the explosion, the rescue boat. I realized then what an incredible gift I had been given, to be in some miraculous way, rescued from something for which I had no right, no expectation to live through that. The way that, in the moment of the explosion, the boat was reduced to the tiniest scraps of driftwood left floating on the surface. Big chunks went straight to the seabed. There was just rubbish there, and the damage that was done to the fabric of the boat, really, when I look back, I feel nothing but wonder and gratitude to the fact that I was able to come away and live.
And indeed your parents as well. But when you went back, what sort of reaction did you get from people? Was there a sense that you found maybe some of them almost embarrassed by their memory of what had happened, that people in some respects want to forget what had happened?
Well, Matt, obviously with the passage of years, a great deal of timing, a great deal of healing had passed in that time, and that was wonderful. But really what amazed me as I started to work my way back and just quietly call on people that I'd known in my childhood and talk to them, the predominant thing that came out time and time again was their warmth, their degree to which they would like to welcome me back, but also their own sense of not having had a goodbye. There was that day after generations of my family having had a home in that community, where suddenly, with a brutal finality, there was this explosion. And people, our neighbours and friends, the community, had not been able to have their own sense of goodbye. And I felt as they were talking to me, time and again people said how much they had enjoyed the conversation, how much it had meant to them. And to some small degree, there was a little bit of healing, it seemed to me, that needed to be done on their part as well as mine. And that's what I took away.
Did you come across anybody who might have attempted to try and justify these murders?
Well, it's a very complicated equation. I understand that. And I understand that at all times I kept my eye focused on the future and on the personal process I was going through. So I never tried to tie this into a wider political picture. I needed to understand some of the backdrop, but I never tried to connect it in any way that was other than just me personally, as a 14-year-old child, unable to make sense of it and heal fully, going back as somebody approaching my 40th birthday and making good on that process and reaping huge rewards and living now in a new state of forgiveness and with an acceptance that I've said my final goodbye to my twin brother Nicholas, which really is what I've done through this book, From a Clear Blue Sky, and really enjoying life with a fantastic wife and five wonderful children. It's something that, well, I feel we all have a certain amount of luck in our lives, and I had incredible luck in having Nicholas for a twin for the first nearly 15 years of my life, and the luck that I have now with my health, but also this wonderful life I have with young children and a fantastic wife.
And when your children get older and when they read this book, what do you think they will make of it?
Well, already our children, the oldest of them is 9, they're curious, they want to know. And I'm keen that they shouldn't just have that part of our family's painful history airbrushed out. They should know about their 5 wonderful aunts and uncles who are living, but also about the wonderful one who died that day. It was a remarkable life, albeit a short one, that he lived, beautiful one. And he is somebody who's terribly important to me, and it's a wonderful gift for my children, for me to give my children, to know about him. So they ask me. They say to me, they're aware about the bomb, and they ask me about it. Tell me, Daddy, who was on the boat that day? And where were you? And who died, Daddy? Who was it who died? And I tell them. And somebody once said, with relation to the Troubles, that for it to be unrepeatable, it must be unforgettable. And I hope that in some small way I've put another chip into reminding my family, the younger generation of my family and friends, and maybe people beyond that. That's something that shouldn't be forgotten, but certainly we should always keep our eye on the future and be looking at the healing and reaching out and remembering that, the greatest gift I came away with was the lack of bitterness that my parents had. That infected me, it inspired me, and I've never lived my day with a moment of recrimination. There's been flashes of anger, of course, years ago, in the aftermath immediately, but that's all washed away, and I'm just so happy to find that increasingly the island is entering a new stage of a really peaceful existence, and please God that may continue.
Timothy Nashville, thank you very much for taking the time to join us. The book is called From a Clear Blue Sky.